is the Israel Connection on JA Community Radio, broadcasting live on 88 FM and streaming over the internet at j-air.com.au. My name is David Schulberg, bringing you another episode of this weekly radio program that provides analysis and insight with important interviews and discussion about Israel. My guest to start the show today is the recently appointed CEO of the Zionist Federation of Australia, Alon Kossuto, who's responsible for leading the organisation through the most challenging times being faced by Australia's Jewish community. Alon Kossuto is an accomplished lawyer and management consultant, born and raised in Jerusalem, the former youth movement Madrich, or leader, Orgis and Israel programs leader, and chair of the Young Australia-Israel Chamber of Commerce. Kossuto embodies the spirit of activism and advocacy that is at the core of the Zionist Federation of Australia's mission. So welcome to the Israel Connection, Alon.
Thank you, David. Great to be here.
So, Alon, how did you find your way into this role of being the CEO of the Zionist Federation of Australia?
Well, David, my connection with Israel and the Jewish community starts before I was even born. My very existence, my life, is the result of the Zionist movement and the Zionist dream, in that my mother grew up in Melbourne and was involved with the youth movement Beitar. And when she reached the age of 18, she went to Israel and made Aliyah. And there she met my father, who had a very similar story on the other side of the world. My father grew up in a city called Livorno in Tuscany in Italy. And he was involved in Bnei Akiva, the youth movement, and he too made Aliyah, moved to Israel at the age of 18, and my parents met in Jerusalem, where they were both studying at the Hebrew University. So they raised me in a household that had an Australian mother, and I spoke English to my mother. I had an Italian father, and I spoke Italian to my father. And I spoke Hebrew at school and was raised as another Jewish Israeli with a very mixed cultural background. And growing up in Jerusalem was quite a magical and remarkable place. I remember being surrounded by lots of different cultures, and at my core knowing that there was something very special about the city that I grew up in, and knowing the story of diaspora Jewry, because every second summer holiday I would go either to Australia or to Italy and be a part of the Jewish community there, going to synagogues in the diaspora and being a part of those magical communities. And so, in a sense, when I came to Australia, I moved to Australia at the age of 15 and finished my high school education at Scopus. Australia was both very foreign for me as a child who grew up in Israel, but also very familiar because I had visited so much and had family here. And I realized that we are a part of a pretty special community here in Melbourne. I got very involved in Hineini, the youth movement, where, as you mentioned, I was a Madrich. And then I went on to get very involved with the Australasian Union of Jewish Students, Orgis, where I studied law at Melbourne University and arts. And when I spent those 5 years at the University of Melbourne, I spent far more time as an activist on campus and getting involved in Orgis, leading various campaigns and Israel programs and activities than I ever did in law lectures. And that reawakened my passion for community activism. When I graduated university, I found myself practicing law for a number of years and then moving into the tech world and running my own tech startup, and ultimately then into management consulting, where I was very privileged to work with some of the top CEOs and executives across Australia on their strategy, on their culture, and on their leadership, and helping them really get performance out of their teams and organizations. And all throughout that time, I had a parallel communal life where I was very active in the Young Australia-Israel Chamber of Commerce, which was a non-profit for young professionals that helped bring really Israel into the fore as a really magical, innovative country that has so much to offer Australia beyond the headlines. And in that organization, I got to really have an outlet for my passion for Zionism and community activism. I got a tap on the shoulder last year and was asked whether I'd consider the role of CEO of the Zionist Federation of Australia. And the Zionist Federation was an organization I was very familiar with, having led lots of programs to Israel and youth movements and orgias, all of which come under the custodianship of the Zionist Federation. And I had a wonderful conversation with our president, Jeremy Liebler, who painted the vision of what he thought was possible and just how profoundly fundamental the Zionist Federation has been to Jewish identity in Australia and the Australia-Israel connection. And I realized that it's where I wanted to be. And interestingly, this was just a number of weeks before the 7th of October. And so, as we all know, on the 7th of October, all our worlds got turned upside down and our hearts were ripped out of our chests. And my very first interview for this role followed the 7th of October in that week. And I sat down with the board and we all agreed we couldn't have a normal interview given the week we'd had. But that there was no place we'd rather be. And we had a conversation about the importance of the Zionist Federation and this role now more than ever. And a few weeks later, I was offered the position and I accepted it. And it feels like a real calling and a mission, because when I think of the Zionist Federation and the role that we have to do in terms of building a thriving Jewish community and a deep connection between Australia and Israel, and ensuring really that both Australia and Israel continue to be friends and have a depth of connection for generations to come, there's never been a more important time. And I think right now our Jewish community is feeling the effects 6 months on. We're seeing increasing hostility. We're seeing at the same time a reawakened passion in so many Jews. And I think all of that means that there's never been a more important time for the Zionist Federation to lean in and lead and connect our people.
Well, I certainly commend the ZFA on choosing you for the role. With your pedigree, I think you certainly should be able to do the job. But it's early days at the moment. Your president, Jeremy Liebler, you work very closely with. Can you just distinguish the how your duties compare? You're a full-time employee of the ZFA, while Jeremy is not. He's an honorary president. So what's the distinction in terms of the way you present in terms of the ZFA and your public face?
So it's an excellent question. Jeremy's done a tremendous job over the past 4 years at really setting up the Zionist Federation to be an incredibly impactful organization. And he's done a number of things that have been very important for our community. He's put advocacy at the center of a lot of what the Zionist Federation does. And I know that the community is very grateful to have a strong leading advocate like Jeremy and the ZFA in advocating for so many of the issues that matter most to our community. And Jeremy's also invested a lot in our future generations. Jeremy's done a really important job in really securing our ability to send young people to Israel in the hundreds every year. Jeremy's done a phenomenal job at broadening the tent of the Zionist Federation of Australia and welcoming in all different organizations and affiliates and Jews who really cover all sides of the spectrum politically and religiously. And in that respect, I think there's a real strength of leadership there that has made a real difference to our community. And I can say with certainty that Jeremy is a large part of the reason why I'm in this role. I think the relationship between a CEO and president is incredibly important, and you have to have immense respect for the person you work closely with. And Jeremy, as honorary president for the past 4 years, has really built an organization that I feel proud to now be able to step into and lead in a professional capacity. I suppose the main difference is that Jeremy does have another day job. He's a partner at one of the top law firms in the country, and he has a lot of clients that depend on him. And the amount of time he invests in our community and in the Zionist Federation is truly astounding. and I hope to be able to, in some respects, support him and relieve him of some of the duties that he's been left carrying for a long time.
Yeah, I wonder how much time he has for his kids. Anyway, you say, you have said that October the 7th has shaken the Jewish community, and you've called it a line in the sand. So what special initiatives are you pursuing that have not been a part and parcel of the Zionist Federation of Australia strategy before October the 7th?
Well, David, what's happened since October the 7th is that we've seen two immense forces. We've seen, on the one hand, the incredible force come from within our community of a true reawakening, a real sense of unity. So many Jews who have historically seen their Jewish identity or Israel on the periphery of their existence and suddenly have had a real clarification and alignment where Israel is at the core of how they see themselves and their families and their role on this earth. And what that's meant is that we've seen a whole new dimension to our community of grassroots activists, of initiatives, of people who wanted to take up the role of advocates and passionate activists. And that's exciting. It's really exciting because there's been a real renaissance of Jewish identity. And what that means for us as community organizations is that we need to be able to harness that and channel that. The other force is something that we'd probably underestimated, and I can say I certainly underestimated, which is the hostility towards Israel and towards our community that is that exists in some pockets of Australian society. And it's not the majority of Australians, but it is a very vocal and very disturbing minority, whether it's progressives, whether it's people from the Islamic community. We've seen a real attack on certain members of our community, whether it's through doxing, whether it's through violent protests, whether it's through online harassment and bullying. And what that's resulted in, I think, is a need for our community to really level up its ability to protect itself, to advocate for itself, to advocate for Israel, to build alliances with other communities, to build deep relationships with government, deep relationships with law enforcement, deep relationships with the media. And ultimately, I think if we talk about what are the Australian values that we want to preserve, it's on us as leaders and as advocates to ensure that Australia remains a place where Jews feel comfortable to be who they are, to live their lives, to continue their love and support for the State of Israel, and never feel like they have to shy away or hide their identity.
Yeah, one of the initiatives actually that has come to be since October the 7th concerns our radio station, JAIR, where we do regular bulletins on our station. So that's one of the cooperations or collaborations that has emerged out of October the 7th, because I think before October the 7th, the relationship between the ZFA and JAIR was somewhat less tangible.
Well, I think post 7th of October, I think all Jews have benefited from a unity that we didn't see before. And I think the Zionist Federation of Australia is actively trying to broaden the tent, but also support as many new activists and initiatives as possible. So you asked me about some of the initiatives. Let me tell you about some of them. We've recently had an advocacy workshop with a number of grassroots activists, and we held it at our community centre of Bet Weitzman, and 80% of the faces were new. They were people who'd never regularly come to Bet Weitzman.
And young,
and that's exciting. Similarly, we are being really intentional about investing in our youth. We sent a delegation of 17 young leaders from all the different youth movements and orgies to Israel. And it was important for us that if they are to lead their movements and have an impact on all the people that look up to them, it was important that they'd experienced Israel firsthand. That was the ZFA Young Leaders Mission. Similarly, we are very active on the advocacy front. We are having regular communication with many of the decision makers and policy makers in our country. We've taken a strong stance on the consultation on doxing legislation and made a submission to government on what we believe ought to be done to prevent future doxing and exposure of Jewish people online in a way that causes intimidation and harassment. And we've also been very intentional about greater coordination across the leading Jewish organizations across the country, and also with grassroots activists, which we know are doing so much important work at the moment.
Thank you. I want to refer you to an interview that you've done with Ramona Craypot on the Social Blueprint. And if you'll permit me, I'm going to play a short excerpt to remind you what you said there in response to a question about dealing with anti-Semitism in our society.
Antidote to anti-Semitism is our resilience, as well as our broader connection. So the resilience comes from that strength of Jewish identity. The broader connection comes from building relationships with communities who see what we see and see the world the same way as we do and believe what we believe. So whether that be the Christians that we're getting organized to run rallies saying that anti-Semitism is un-Australian with, whether that be Hindus who we're inviting to come and visit the Jewish Museum and Holocaust Museum with us and connect with on a deeper level so we can understand their culture and they can understand ours. Whether that's wonderful programs like Connecting Cultures that Zionism Victoria does, where young Jews go out and speak to different schools, whether that be taking students to the new Holocaust Museum that's just been built from across Victoria, or whether that be some of the interfaith work that I know has taken a hit but needs to get back on track. All of that to me is the antidote to anti-Semitism. And I also think we need to be loud and proud. The best antidote to anti-Semitism are Jews who have conviction, a real clarity and conviction around this is why, what we are as Jews. No one gets to define that for us. This is what we stand for. And we are as Australian as anyone. We have contributed in droves to this country, disproportionately have for generations. We will not be shy about either our Jewish identity, our Zionist identity, or our Australian identity.
Well, I'm sure you can remember saying that, Alon. It's nice to be finding allies that support us, as you were speaking there. But what is going on, though, to tackle and confront the active purveyors of anti-Semitism in our society? I just would put the question to you that I think some people might be asking is this approach sufficient to deal with anti-Semitism? Is it strong enough? Shouldn't we be out there in a more forthright way? I mean, one of the things I heard when Michael Kroger spoke at a talk at Beth Weissman was he said we should be camping outside Adam Band's office and with a vigil 24 hours a day, calling the Greens out for being anti-Semites. Mm. So what do you think about comments that suggest that we should be more strong about dealing with anti-Semitism, not necessarily just looking for allies?
David, I think anti-Semitism's a real problem, and I'll be the first to admit that I've been surprised by the level of anti-Semitism in Australia, and I think a lot of people have from the conversations I'm having. At the same time, anti-Semitism's been around since time immemorial. It's not a new phenomenon, and it's certainly not something that's going to go away. As Jews and as leaders within the Jewish community, I do think we need to do everything in our power to combat anti-Semitism. And how we do that, I think there are a lot of different ways. I don't think there's one silver bullet. I think, as I said in the interview, I think it's through building a depth and strength of Jewish identity in our community and in our youth, so that no one shies away from being a proud Jew and no one feels the need to compartmentalize it as they go out into broader society. Because I'm deeply proud of most of the Jews I meet, and I want others who are not Jewish to know that they've met a Jew. I don't want Jews to have to hide away their identity. So I think that's an important aspect that we play a critical part in through the touch points that we know build Jewish identity through Jewish youth movements, through Israel programs, through Jewish day schools, through activity in our community. I also think that, as I said in the Social Blueprint interview, being able to build alliances and relationships with other communities is incredibly important. I spoke with Chris Minns, the New South Wales Premier, and he told me about the reason he is so fundamentally supportive of the Jewish community today. And it was because of his Year 11 teacher who took the whole class to the Holocaust Museum and then debriefed it for weeks afterwards about the experience and what it meant and how they processed it and what it might have been like to be a Jew suffering from extreme anti-Semitism and ultimately have a third of your world decimated as our people had during the Holocaust. And so Chris Minns spoke of the fact that that is a driving force behind his connection and relationship with the Jewish community and Israel till today. So my question is, how do we target the next however many hundreds of thousands of Chris Minns out there across Australia who are currently in schools by making sure that they meet Jews? They know who we are, they know what we stand for, they know about our history, and they know why Israel is important to us. I also think there is a role for us to be strong and push back and say anti-Semitism is un-Australian and we're not prepared to accept it, not from the radical left and not from the radical right and not from anyone in Australia who purports to be an Australian, because there's no room for racism, there's no room for anti-Semitism in Australia. One of the large campaigns that I was proud to be deeply involved in was the Say No to Anti-Semitism campaign, which created a groundswell. If you remember, it was the 800 plus leaders who'd signed the statement against anti-Semitism, which went on to feature on the front page of every newspaper in Australia in November. We had a social media campaign that was seen by millions of Australians, and it is still on billboards up around the place, including just around the corner on North Road. I think what is critical is that anti-Semitism is shown to be something that is deeply in conflict with who we are and what we stand for as Australians. It's shown to be an irrational fear and hatred and racist sentiment that is not grounded in reality, because most people, when they meet a Jew and they sit down for a Jew and they build a relationship with a Jew, that hate dissipates very quickly. And I think that's our job.
One of the pastimes you have is cycling. Now, I can share with you that I actually am a cyclist too. I go out every week on the bike. I've got some Israeli Startup Nation cycling gear.
Mm.
At the moment, I can't wear it. Well, I could wear it, but I would be inviting trouble, and the other guys that go cycling with would not like me to wear it as well. So this is one of the things, the fallout of what's happened, is that our identity, we have to be very careful about being out there openly about our identity. And this is something that obviously needs to be addressed. And obviously you're concerned about it, but I don't think our authorities are doing enough about it.
It's a sad reality, David. I agree. I was in Adelaide in January with some friends, and we were cycling around, and we were there to support the Israel Startup Nation as they raced in the Tour Down Under, which is the most famous bike race in Australia. And we had Israeli flags with us, and we pulled them out, and there was a discussion as a cycling group. There were six of us there, and we had a discussion. Do we feel comfortable waving the Israeli flag in Adelaide? Eventually we decided we would, but we did have a moment of hesitation. And it's funny because my mother's just landed in Israel, and she sent me a photo of my uncle's car. And my uncle's car has a huge poster of a young girl who's a hostage right now, and it's a daughter of a friend of his that he's been working with for 20 years. and the car drives around with this photo on it all the time. And the sad thing is that my first internal reaction was, I wouldn't be able to do that in Australia, because if I parked my car on an Australian street and it had a photo of a hostage on it, I would come back to a car that could be defaced or even worse, vandalized. And that's the sad reality of Australia that we're living in. I remember early on going and putting, in October, November, putting posters of hostages up and seeing them ripped down within a day or two. And this was, it's the difference between living in the diaspora and living in Israel. And part of that, I think, is not accepting that that has to be the case, fighting back, being proud. And part of it is also recognizing that there are important battles to wage and there are less important battles to wage. And if we need to decide where to invest our time and energy, then as a community, as leaders, we need to know what are the red lines, what are the lines in the sand that we're not prepared to tolerate.
You pride yourself in your relatively new role of striving for inclusivity, Alon. So I want to ask you, what is your relationship with some organisations that are not sometimes viewed in a very friendly fashion? I know that Jeremy Lieber said some words about the AJA, for example, the Australian Jewish Association. Now, I think you'd probably be very envious of the social media footprint that they've established. What's your relationship with them? What's your relationship with the more newly formed Jewish Council of Australia? Can you bring them into the fold, or are they too far to the extreme? What's your relationship with the Australian Jewish Democratic Society, I think, who once again have crossed the red line in terms of calling for boycotts of Israeli products? And then it comes to mind the New Israel Fund too, which bothers a lot of people. How are these organisations accepted by the Zionist Federation?
David, one of the wonderful sayings that we often hear is two Jews, three opinions. And I think the beauty is that it's not my role to convince Jews what they should or shouldn't believe. What I do know is that the Zionist Federation of Australia has been around since 1927, and we're a broad tent and always have been. And we have Jews from the left and Jews from the right, and religious Jews and secular Jews and everything in between. Some of our affiliates include HaShomer HaTzair and Meretz Australia, who are on the left. We have B'nai Akiva and Mizrahi, who are religious and on the right of the political spectrum. We have Beitar, we have Friends of Likud. And so, in a sense, if I look to which organizations represent the broadest of tents, we are the organization that's the elected representative. Our affiliates have members and they sign up to be affiliates of the Zionist Federation. And in that respect, I feel that with our 100-year history and with the tremendous amount of impact we've had since Sir John Monash founded us, there's something about the depth and credibility that comes with that. And that's why we are the ones who generally tend to receive calls when important members of Australian society are trying to understand what's front of mind for the Australian Jewish community. And though we don't purport to speak on behalf of every Jew, and that would be preposterous for us to do it, I do feel that there's a certain gravitas and legitimacy that we have. I'm not going to comment on any other organisation, but I will say that I'm yet to meet a Jew that I'm not prepared to sit down and have a civilized conversation with. And if they disagree with me, then I think that's a blessing, because I don't want to surround myself with people I always agree with.
All right. Now, the Zionist Federation of Australia represents the community at the highest levels of government. I think we need to bring things into the current perspective because of what's happened with the Labor government through Penny Wong talking about the potential for a two-state solution at this time. So what is the relationship like right now between the ZFA and our federal government in particular, especially after the accidental killing of the seven aid workers last week, which has seen a huge amount of moral outrage stemming from our political leaders, which I think many in our community think is really going way beyond the pale.
David, I think what happened with the tragic death of the aid workers is horrible. It's horrible. People who fly over there to try and feed helpless, innocent people should be protected, and when there are mistakes and they tragically die, it's a horrific, horrific tragedy. I think everyone in our community has acknowledged that. I think at the same time, there's the fact that there are still 133 of our brothers and sisters who are not home with their families and remain hostages in the...
Well, you say 133. I doubt that number is the case. I mean, I've had inside information that suggests that barely half that number are still alive.
I don't want to go into the details yes, okay. on that. But I think that the fact that our hostages are not home and they remain in the underground terror tunnels and dungeons of Hamas is equally as tragic and outrageous. In fact, more so. And if I were to turn my mind to what does all this mean, it means that we need Israel and Israelis to be able to live in peace and security. This means a future without Hamas. It means our hostages are returned home. It means a reality where there isn't a threat of October 7th happening again and again, looming over our heads. And in that respect, I think the Australian government has to recognise the reality that the Jewish community has very front of mind, which is that the idea of a future Palestinian state is acceptable to most Jews in theory. The idea that now the timing is correct is preposterous, and that's in the context of the 7th of October having happened only 6 months ago, Hamas still being in power in Gaza, our hostages not being home, and ultimately there just aren't the conditions on the ground for a Palestinian state to be discussed. You've still got a war going on, and you've still got infinite questions around how this war is going to end. And the proposal from the government that the Palestinian Authority is fit to rule is also disconnected from reality, because the Palestinian Authority can barely rule the West Bank and has been essentially a corrupt, dysfunctional regime for the past 16 years, and the idea that they could come into Gaza and rule Gaza is unrealistic. So until you have a deep de-radicalization of Palestinian society, until you have a complete emergence of new and different leadership within Palestinian people, and until you renounce all violence and corruption and recognize Israel's right to exist, there's simply no room to be discussing a Palestinian state. At the same time, I have to say, I remain hopeful.
Well, I've enjoyed talking to you today, Alon, and time has run away. I think I've been unable to get to a number of questions I was wanting to broach with you today, but let's perhaps save those for another time. You're not going away soon. I don't expect to either. So I thank you very much for speaking to me today on the Israel Connection, Alon.
Thank you, David. Thanks for having me.
So I've just been talking with Alon Kosuto, who is the relatively newly appointed CEO of the Zionist Federation of Australia. Shimon Friedman is a COGAT spokesperson for international media, COGAT being the official Israeli unit responsible for the coordination of government activities in the territories, tasked with the coordination and facilitation of humanitarian initiatives to assist the civilian population in Gaza, and in doing so, is doing so in coordination with the international community. I'm delighted to welcome Shimon Friedman, who is a COGAT spokesman for international media. Welcome to the Israel Connection here in Australia, Shimon.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be with you.
Now, Shimon, you will no doubt be aware that there's been a lot of concern over the World Central Kitchen incident where seven aid workers were killed accidentally. Now, was COGAT actually directly responsible for coordinating that aid delivery that they were involved with?
So let me start by saying that what took place last week with the World Central Kitchen was a tragic mistake. It was a terrible, terrible tragedy, and it should not have happened. And we've expressed, COGAT in Israel, and we've all expressed our deepest sorrow for the incident, and we've sent our condolences to the families of those who were killed. We also launched independent professional investigation into it and have already released some of those results. In terms of coordination, Israel, through COGAT, coordinates with all the different international organizations that are operating in the Gaza Strip, and we coordinate their movements within Gaza to make sure that humanitarian aid is getting to where it needs to get to.
So will you have any involvement, though, with Australia's appointment of an independent investigator, a former military chief? Is that something that you will be connected with?
So that's not something that COGAT will be involved with. No, that's something on the IDF side of things, not on the COGAT side of things.
Okay. So but Israel, as far as I'm aware, hasn't yet agreed to an acceptance of that request by Australia.
To be perfectly honest, I'm not quite sure where that stands. It's just not something that really COGAT is involved with.
So because of the concerns over aid distribution, COGAT has been reviewing its processes to better ensure the safe distribution of humanitarian aid in Gaza. Do you want to go through some of the latest steps that are being taken to improve the situation?
So I think maybe before going into the steps that need to be improved, it might be worth just kind of giving an overview of how that looks and how we've been operating, if that's all right with you. If we really take the process of facilitating humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip and we simplify it, there are three main steps here. And the first one is gathering or collecting the humanitarian aid. The aid is donated by international organizations and by different countries, and usually makes its way to the El Arish port in Egypt. And that's really the first step, is collecting that aid and packing it onto trucks. The second step is the security inspection, and that's kind of what Israel is focused on. And so the aid that makes its way to Egypt then makes its way to two crossings in Israel. We started with one crossing in Itzana, we've added the second one in Kerem Shalom, and there the humanitarian aid goes through security inspection and then makes its way into the Gaza Strip. It's offloaded from the trucks onto the Gaza Strip. If it's in Kerem Shalom, it can just be offloaded onto the Gaza side because that's a crossing between Israel and Gaza. If it's through Nitzana, it goes back through Egypt, through the Rafah crossing, and dropped off at the Gaza side of the Rafah crossing. And then the third step is the issue of distribution. So once the aid has been inspected and it's in the Gaza Strip, it needs to make its way to the different places in the Gaza Strip where it is needed. And that is where the international organizations really are responsible for the distribution and the maneuvering, storing and maneuvering of the aid. And that's actually where we've seen a lot of the problems so far and backlogs of humanitarian aid. You know, sometimes we see hundreds of trucks worth of aid sitting on the Gaza side of Kerem Shalom, waiting to be picked up and distributed. While the responsibility for distribution is one that is on the international organizations, we've been taking different steps to assist in that distribution process and also to bypass some of those distribution issues. So some of those steps that we've taken has been working with different countries on airdrops of aid, so those can get to where they need to get to directly, opening an additional crossing in northern Gaza, in crossing 96, and all different kinds of steps that we've taken. Because at the end of the day, you know, Israel understands that our war is with Hamas. It's not with the people of Gaza. And so we want to make sure that we're seeing humanitarian aid get to where we want, to where it needs to get to.
According to Israel, the distribution within Gaza, not the supply from without, is the major obstacle.
Yeah.
Would you? So what are the? I mean, is when the trucks you say are waiting to come into Gaza, are these trucks that have already been inspected by Israel and they're just waiting to arrive somewhere in Gaza?
So the trucks that are waiting, what I just described previously, is what happens is the aid will come to a crossing in Israel, either Nitzan or Kerem Shalom. The trucks and the humanitarian aid will be inspected, and then they offload the aid onto the Gazan side of the border, and that's where it is picked up by the international organization. So what we're seeing is that sometimes there's hundreds of trucks worth of aid just sitting at the Kerem Shalom, on the Gazan side of the Kerem Shalom crossing. It hasn't been picked up and it hasn't been distributed yet.
So there has been much criticism that Israel isn't letting enough aid come into Gaza, and fear-mongering about the potentials for starvation and so forth. You would say that this is not the case, that it's actually just a problem of distribution, and all this would be remedied.
So I think it's worth mentioning two things here. One is that Israel has placed no limit on the amount of humanitarian aid that can make its way into the Gaza Strip. And, you know, if someone wants to see more aid coming in, they're more than welcome to send additional aid and we will facilitate it. But I think it's also worth mentioning what, you know, when we say we think that there's sufficient amount of aid making its way into the Gaza Strip, why we're saying that. And that's because we, since the beginning of the war, have had a team dedicated to assessing the humanitarian situation on the ground. So a team that is in touch with probably hundreds of people on the ground, speaks with the international organizations and different partners to get all the relevant information and understand what the humanitarian situation is. And when we speak about the humanitarian situation, I'm talking about food and water, but also access to medical care, access to shelters, and so on. So that team, on a daily basis, creates a new assessment. And then we also have daily meetings with the international organizations on the ground. We meet with them in the morning and in the evening, and that allows us to, based on our assessment of the situation, prioritize what needs to make its way in, to coordinate different convoys to different parts of the Gaza Strip so that humanitarian aid is getting to where it needs to get to. So we're taking all these different steps to make sure that humanitarian aid can reach where it needs to get to, and that we understand what needs to be the priority. But as I started, we haven't placed a limit on the amount of humanitarian aid that we are willing to facilitate.
And reports that are coming out of Israel, I'm speaking particularly of Times of Israel, suggest that the delivery of aid coming now into Gaza is the largest quantity of aid that's been arriving in Gaza since the outbreak of the war in Gaza against Hamas.
Yeah, we've seen over the past few days larger amounts of humanitarian aid coming in, and I think, you know, that it just speaks to what I just mentioned. We've placed no limit on the amount that can come in. And if more aid is sent to us to inspect and facilitate into the Gaza Strip, that's what we'll do.
But the amount coming into Gaza, how does that compare to what was coming into Gaza prior to October 7?
So I think this is, it's a great question, because I think there are a few misconceptions here. So the average number of trucks that were coming into Gaza before the beginning of the war was around 500 trucks. However, those 500 trucks were not carrying humanitarian aid. They were carrying many different things. It could have been clothing or building equipment or lots of different things within those 500 trucks. In terms of food, the average daily amount of trucks before the war was around 70 trucks. The average today, over the last few weeks, has been probably double that, and maybe over the past couple of days, even more. So it's important to understand that what's coming in now, what we're prioritizing to bring into the Gaza Strip right now, is humanitarian aid under four categories: food, water, medical supplies, and shelter equipment. So comparing what came in before the war and during the war is not necessarily, you know, comparing apples to apples.
There are these remarks that are coming from various UN agencies, and one particular report from the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification has claimed that famine is now projected and imminent in North Gaza and Gaza governorates, and is expected to become manifest during the projection period coming into May. Now, you've replied in your report, responding to that, that this does not reflect the full situation in the Gaza Strip. Well, what do you say about the reports that say starvation is imminent? Is this overplaying the situation for particular reasons because organisations have their agenda?
So the IPCC report that you just mentioned, there are quite a few problems with it. So one is in terms of their methodology. First of all, they've admitted themselves that they have gaps in information there. Another one is that they're relying on information from the Hamas Ministry of Health, which is not a reliable source in any way, shape or form. But besides that, it's also important to note that their projections looking forward kind of ignore the steps that Israel took in recent months. So they stopped collecting data around the beginning of March. And since the beginning of March, we've taken many steps to increase the amount of humanitarian aid getting to where it needs to get to. So some of them I've already mentioned in terms of opening an additional crossing in the north, having airdrops of aid in the north, increasing the amount of trucks making their way through private sector. So we've taken lots of different steps, and that's why we disagree with their assessment of the situation on the ground.
Now, I would suggest to listeners, actually, that they should go and look at your website where you provide link to the full figures of Israel's humanitarian efforts during its war against Hamas. And maybe you can run through some of the kinds of information that is available there, which is very pertinent to what the situation is in Gaza.
Yeah, well, thank you for mentioning the website. Yeah, we have a website where we update with information, and also on our Twitter account, we update, you know, with numbers daily, trucks that are coming in and so on. As I said, Israel's placed no limit on the amount of humanitarian aid that can make its way in it. And we want to facilitate humanitarian aid and make sure that it's getting to where it needs to get to. And so we've been taking lots of different steps in order to do that. And we stand willing to facilitate additional aid. And as the numbers, as you mentioned, that the past couple of weeks suggest, you know, we have that capacity. As I mentioned, we started with inspecting the trucks at the Nitzana crossing, and then we added the Kerem Shalom crossing. In both of those crossings, we also added lots of, increased our capabilities. So we added manpower, we extended working hours, we added additional equipment. And all of those steps allowed us to get to a point where we can inspect 44 trucks an hour at both crossings combined. So that's a very large capacity for inspection. And we are more than willing to inspect that number of trucks and help facilitate the aid to make sure it's getting to where it needs to get to. Our war, you know, is with Hamas. And that's, you know, that's what we're focused on.
So on your website, a lot of this information is available. One particular graph there would be of interest, I think, to people is the list of donating countries, which shows that Turkey and the UAE are supplying more than 50% of the aid that's coming into Gaza. And it doesn't show barely a single Western country that is involved there.
So, yeah, there are different initiatives that different countries are involved with. And the UAE is definitely one that is heavily involved in bringing humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip. Yeah, we stand willing to work with countries who want to donate humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip, and we work with them in different ways. Providing the humanitarian aid is one way, but there are also seven field hospitals operating in the Gaza Strip right now. There were two floating hospitals, a French one and an Italian one, docked at El Arish receiving patients. There's now a UAE floating hospital. So there's lots of different initiatives, and there's the airdropping of aid where different countries are involved.
So where you've been saying that there are no limits or restrictions on aid, you've noted back on the 29th of March that 23% of the humanitarian aid that has entered Gaza since January has not been distributed. And you've asserted that Hamas may be hijacking it, or it may be piling up in aid agencies' warehouses. One of the key questions, I suppose, is how much of the aid is actually getting into the hands of innocent civilians, and how much is being taken for Hamas's nefarious purposes.
I can't quantify it, but I can tell you that as I mentioned, the distribution is a question that is up to the international organizations, right? We will facilitate the aid, we'll inspect it, and we'll drop it off on the Gaza side of the border. And then it's up to the international organizations to collect that, put it in storage, and distribute it. And unfortunately, what we've seen is that while we've increased our capacity for security inspection, we haven't necessarily seen them increase their capacity of distribution. And there are different steps that can be taken on the logistical side, increasing the number of trucks, increasing their working hours and storage units, and lots of different steps that can be taken. But we are working together with them, and we stand ready to facilitate additional steps for them to be able to distribute the aid, because we want to see the aid getting to who it needs to get to.
Now, the current head of the organization for which you're a spokesperson, the coordinator of government activities in the territories, is Major General Ghassan Alian, and he's been in contact with local leaders who weren't affiliated with Hamas in order to organize the protection of the humanitarian aid convoys by local armed groups. The report stated that most factions refused this suggestion or offer. However, a large clan reportedly agreed, and another one is apparently considering the proposal. Now, can you please tell us what this is actually telling us about the prospects of cooperation with those who are on the ground in Gaza? And before you answer, I want to say this to my listeners, that I'd like to point out to my listeners that Ghassan Alian is in fact not Jewish. So the head of the organization that you work for is in fact an Israeli Druze officer, which I think would be of some note, I think, for people to be aware of.
So in terms of the issue of, you know, collaboration with people on the ground and what the future looks like, that's not something that COGAT can comment on. Unfortunately, I can't be part of that conversation for you. That's, you know, a question for the political level in terms of what the future looks like.
Okay. One other point, I think maybe you may not be able to answer this as well. In the past few days, following what's happened, I think, with the aid workers, a new humanitarian coordination and deconfliction cell has been set up as part of a new set of steps, which I was alluding to, I think, when we started to speak, to improve the situation of the Palestinians in Gaza. Is this something that your organization is having an involvement with?
So the new coordination cell is one that that was built in order to continue facilitating and coordinating additional convoys with the international organizations. And that is something, yes, that COGAT is involved with. And the idea here is to just improve even more our coordination and our communication with the international organizations so that we can coordinate their movements within the Gaza Strip. And coordination in general with the international organizations is something that we do on a daily basis. And we coordinate movements probably dozens of times a day, different organizations. Again, we want to see the humanitarian aid getting to where it needs to get to. And so we work very closely with the international organizations on this.
Now, you're located in Tel Aviv, I understand. Have you been in Gaza at all since the war started?
I've been on the outskirts of Gaza. I am located in Tel Aviv. COGAT has, offices right on the border and here in the center of Tel Aviv as well. So I'm based out of here.
I understand that Iraq has agreed to receive wounded Palestinians from Gaza and provide them with treatment in their government and private hospitals. Is this something that you would be involved with in enabling the transfer of people from Gaza to Iraq?
I don't have specific information about Iraq, so I can't comment on that. But I can tell you that the bringing patients out of the Gaza Strip to receive life-saving medical treatment outside of the Gaza Strip is something that we've helped facilitate. And there have been thousands of patients that have already left the Gaza Strip to receive medical care in other countries. Again, I don't have information specifically about Iraq, so I can't comment on that.
But whereas in the past, Israel would have been at the forefront of providing such medical assistance, at the moment, it's not on the cards, I guess.
So Israel and COGAT specifically was the one who was giving out permits, or the one who's issuing permits for Gazans to receive, you know, life-saving medical treatment in Israel, and also, other permits. And actually the base where COGAT is based out of. So COGAT has an office dedicated to the Gaza CLA, the Coordination Liaison Administration. And that was, its location is adjacent to the Erez Crossing. And on October 7th, that the Erez Crossing was attacked, and so was the Gaza CLA. I think it speaks very much to Hamas's priorities, that they, you know, one of the first things that they attacked was the crossing where people, that people used to come and work in Israel and to receive medical treatment in Israel. That's one of the first things that they attacked. And the people who were issuing those permits are the people that they attacked as well on October 7th.
Yeah, so it hasn't been so easy for Israel to open up these additional crossings because they were very seriously damaged on October the 7th.
Yeah, absolutely. The Erez crossing was very much damaged on October 7th.
One last question I have for you, Shimon, is in relation to what I've just heard today, that UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is now demanding Israel allow foreign journalists to enter Gaza, saying the situation enables false narratives to flourish, the current situation. Is this something that COGAT will be needing to organise or coordinate if Israel accepts it?
No, this isn't really something that that COGAT is involved with.
All right. Well, I, from my own point of view, I would think it would be a very risky proposition to bring these foreign journalists into Gaza, where if we get incidents like what happened with the aid workers, the blame would obviously be levelled at Israel, as it generally does. Thank you very much, yeah, for speaking to me today on the Israel Connection, and the best of luck in your endeavours to end this war that is going on now for over 6 months.
Thank you very much for having me.
You just heard a COGAT spokesperson for international media, Shimon Friedman, speaking to me from Tel Aviv. To finish today, I'd like to play a hollow response that Foreign Minister Penny Wong gave on ABC Radio this morning, where she was asked a critical question that she avoided answering and the ABC presenter let her.
Would you agree that Hamas needs to be removed from power in Gaza?
Hamas has no place in Gaza.
So how do you remove Hamas from Gaza without a ground operation, in your view?
The question here is international humanitarian law and making sure that Israel complies with international humanitarian law. What I would say is this. As I outlined us last night, Israel was attacked in the most horrific terms by an organisation which is dedicated to the destruction of the Jewish people and the destruction of the Jewish state, which is Hamas. And more Jewish lives were lost on that day than any single day since the Holocaust. So any state attacked in that way would defend itself. The point I also made is any state that does defend itself is bound by certain rules. And we are concerned about the humanitarian implications and consequences for civilians in Rafah, as is, you know, the President of the United States. I mean, we have said to Israel, do not go down this path. We know how many Palestinians are sheltering there. People fled because of the conflict in Gaza, and they have nowhere to go. And we are, you know, alongside with the President of the United States and so many others in the international community, we are urging Israel, do not go down this path.
Until next week, it's goodbye from the Israel Connection.
J Air 88 FM.